Edstein in Jerusalem.
Several people are dead and dozens are missing after a strong earthquake shook a central Philippine island and set off landslides. In one mountain village, as many as 30 houses were buried, with several residents believed trapped. Rescuers dug with picks and shovels to try to reach them. At the movies this weekend, a pair of frightening movies almost tied for first place, with $22 million in ticket sales, chronicle about young people with sudden telekinetic abilities. At $21 million in receipts, The Woman in Black, a thriller starring Daniel Radcliffe, a ghost story about a widowed lawyer. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering leopard hoodie footies and women's pajamas delivered overnight and on Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com.
In her recent films, Meryl Streep has transformed herself into Julia Child and now Margaret Thatcher.
It's not about the audience. It's all about fooling the other actors into believing that you are who you say you are, because I can read that immediately in their eyes, you know?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Meryl Streep. Her new film is The Iron Lady. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting More Mozart on Saturday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Sinfonia dedicates an evening of music to Mozart and showcases their talent as soloists and chamber performers. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. In the debate over guns in America, there seems to be very little in the way of middle ground. Yet, it is that territory that our guest, constitutional scholar Adam Winkler, has staked out. While he argues that the Founding Fathers did believe in the right to bear arms, he says that they also believed in gun control laws so extensive that few Americans today would support them. Throughout our history, he says, the two ideas, one, the right to bear arms, and two, the appropriateness of regulations, those things have always stood side by side. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking about the battle over gun ownership, and that is the subject of a recently published book by our guest. The title of the book is Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Norton, W.W. Norton, is the publisher. Our guest, Adam Winkler, is professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and has been featured on CNN, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the New Republic. He's also contributed to the Daily Beast Newsweek, and he's joining us this morning by phone. And Professor Winkler, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Hey, well, thanks very much for talking with us. I'm really struck by something that you write about right up front here in the preface to the book, where you write that when you were working on the book and people were heard that you were writing a book about guns, the very first thing everybody would ask you is this pro-gun or is this anti-gun? And then you go on to explain that what you're hoping to do is, and what you think is actually possible, is that you can indeed find some kind of middle ground that both protects the right of the individual to have a firearm for personal protection and at the same time upholds the notion that regulation is appropriate. And I would expect that probably a lot of people, given how heated this debate has been, particularly in recent years, would say, you know, that's just not possible. You can't do that.
That's right. Well, over the past 30 years, extremists on both sides of the aisle have dominated the gun debate with their simplistic slogans and unreasonable positions. Gun rights hardliners view all gun control proposals as an infringement on the Second Amendment, while gun control hardliners support seemingly any regulation of firearms, no matter how predictably ineffective they are. And so the two sides draw different conclusions, but in some ways they start with the same premise. They both believe that gun control and the right to bear arms cannot coexist. We must choose one or the other. And Gunfight shows how a more balanced understanding of the right to bear arms has prevailed over the course of American history, that the right to bear arms is one of our oldest constitutional rights, yet we've also always had laws regulating guns to promote public safety.
We'll talk about here this, and there, it's a really fascinating story to go all the way back to the early days of America and look at the fact that there were indeed regulations and restrictions on who could have guns. But you begin your story with the most recent case, a recent case from 2008, a Supreme Court case that was, I think, in fact, really the first time, or it would have been the first time in decades, that the court actually made a ruling on the Second Amendment and what the Second Amendment really means. This was the case of D.C., District of Columbia versus Heller.
Yeah, that's right. The Supreme Court had mentioned the Second Amendment in passing through the years, but remarkably, they had never squarely ruled on the meaning of the controversial provision. People had challenged gun laws in court, but they were usually criminals desperately seeking to overturn convictions for some gun crime. But United States against crackhead was not a real promising vehicle for interpreting the Second Amendment. So over the past 30 years, there's been more and more pressure from a social movement to protect gun rights, which formed really in the wake of federal and state gun control laws in the 1960s. And this movement sort of inspired three entrepreneurial libertarian lawyers to bring this Heller lawsuit. And mimicking the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's efforts in the civil rights movement, they strategically recruited ideal, law-abiding plaintiffs and challenged the most restrictive gun law in the nation. And their case was welcomed by an increasingly conservative Supreme Court, even though the NRA, ironically, sought to quash their case at nearly every turn.
That's really an interesting aspect of the story that you write about. And the answer to this question, why, perhaps depends on who you ask. There are some people who make the argument that the reason that the NRA did not want the high court to hear the case was, on the one hand, some people say, well, the reason was the NRA was afraid that they would lose. And there are other people who say, well, actually, they might have been afraid that they would have won.
That's right. Well, you have this lawsuit that's challenging the District of Columbia's ban on handguns and other restrictions on the use of guns for self-defense. And it's really pursued to firm up and cement the NRA's view of the Second Amendment as protecting an individual's right to keep and possess firearms for personal protection. Yet the NRA was vehemently opposed to the case from the get-go. They tried to persuade the lawyers who brought the case not to bring the case. When that didn't work, they tried to actually take over the case, filed another lawsuit, and tried to consolidate the lawsuits so that they could have their own lawyers take it over and distract the courts away from the Second Amendment issue, and even tried to get Congress to pass a law to overturn the D.C. ban on handguns that was the subject of the lawsuit, all because they were afraid of the Supreme Court weighing in. One side, they said that they were afraid of losing, that they didn't want their view of the Second Amendment rejected by the Supreme Court, especially this Supreme Court, with a majority of conservative-leaning justices. Alan Gura, one of these libertarian lawyers who I focused the book on, the lawyer who brought the Heller case, suspected that there was probably another reason, that the NRA was also afraid of winning, that the NRA thrives on crisis-driven fundraising that constantly warns gun owners, you better contribute now or the government's coming to take away your guns. If Gura won, however, and the Second Amendment was firmed up, the government wouldn't be allowed to come take away all your guns. What would happen to the NRA's fundraising machine? Well, for whatever the motive of the NRA, certainly they were on the wrong side of this case from the perspective of the gun rights community.
Yeah. In approaching this case, or at least in the years before this case, it seemed that the argument over the Second Amendment and its meaning was between people who were, on the one hand, said what the Second Amendment does is it guarantees an individual the right to have a firearm for personal protection. So that was the one side. The other side, people said, no, that was not what this was about. They would say the Second Amendment was about the ability of a state to have an armed militia and to be protected from the federal government coming in and disarming the state militia. And so those were the two poles of the argument. What the court ruled in this case was they ruled in favor of those people who said, we think this is about individuals and their right to protect themselves. So one question, why is it that, you know, given that argument had gone on for such a long time, that it took all the way until 2008 for a court to rule on this?
Well, it's really remarkable. I think the Supreme Court for many, many decades just wanted to avoid the Second Amendment. It had no real interest in stepping in And I think one of the stories here that's really interesting is that we think of the Supreme Court as, in some ways, a leader of social movements. We think of Brown versus Board of Education and the Supreme Court being out ahead of the people on that and pushing society to recognize the rights of all people to equal citizenship. But the real story of the court more often is that the court lags behind social movements, that social movements arise and push the court in one direction or another. Say on something like women's rights, it was really the social movement for women's equality that was ahead of the Supreme Court. And today we see a lot more agitation for gay rights outside of the courts than we see, and the court is sort of following along, if you will. And I think that one of the things that happened here is that you had a really strong social movement in favor of stronger protection for gun rights, that the Supreme Court was in some ways bound by its institutional role to recognize. But nonetheless, I like to emphasize that we think of the Second Amendment when we think of the right to bear arms, but that can give us a distorted view in some ways, because regardless of the Second Amendment, the right of individuals to have guns for personal protection is one of our oldest, most established rights. Virtually every state has in its own state constitution a protection for individuals to have access to firearms for self-defense, a right clearly not tied to militia service. So this debate has raged on in the context of the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment is not the only legal protection for the individual to have guns for personal protection.
Yeah, I think one of the things you point out was that very point, that state constitutions have this right, but that also if you look at a much later amendment, the 14th Amendment, one of those that came in after the Civil War, your argument there is that this was clearly designed to protect the rights, in this case, of former slaves, freed slaves, to have guns.
Well, that's right. One of the common mistakes we make in thinking of only the Second Amendment is that we ignore the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was one of those amendments passed right after the Civil War, and one of the goals of the 14th Amendment was to limit the ability of Southern states to restrict the rights of the freedmen. And it turns out that during that period, right after the Civil War, one of the things the Southern states did to try to reestablish white supremacy, to reestablish the second-class citizenship of African Americans, was to pass laws denying African Americans their ability to exercise their constitutionally protected rights, including their right to bear arms. A common feature of the famous, or infamous, I should say, black codes, was to deny African Americans access to guns. And to enforce that, in the South, we saw the rise of posses of white men, racists, who would go out at night, terrorize black communities to take away the guns that the freedmen got, really for the first time during the Civil War era. And those posses morphed and grew and evolved in time to become the KKK. So one of America's most notorious racist organizations began in some ways with gun control at the very top of its agenda, at least gun control for black people.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Adam Winkler. He is professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles. We're talking about the history of the right to bear arms in the United States. That is the subject of his recent book, Gunfight, and it is published by W.W. Norton. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, the thing that I think perhaps frustrates people about the Constitution and gives employment to constitutional lawyers and law scholars is that the way it's written allows some room for interpretation. And the Second Amendment does specifically mention state militias. It doesn't in so many words say the right of an individual to have a gun for his personal protection shall not be infringed. It doesn't say that. You, however, believe that in the Heller case, the court got it right, and that was the intention of the founders. How do you support that argument when the amendment itself does not in so many words say that?
Well, if only our constitutional amendments were crystal clear and we knew exactly what the framers wanted to protect in more detail. You're absolutely right about that. And the Second Amendment is notorious for its ambiguity. It says a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary for the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. You see the problem. There's too many commas there. It's almost as if Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, had just discovered the comma and wanted to use it as many times as possible. But it's created a very ambiguous situation. I think the best way of understanding the amendment is that the intention of the framers was to protect state militias from federal interference. However, the way they did that was by creating a right of individuals to have firearms that could not be denied. And as a result, the state militias would always have an armed populace. The Founding Fathers were very much fearful of a standing army. They thought that the British kings had used standing armies to work injustice and to take away people's liberties, and were determined that national defense would be protected by a citizen's militia, individual citizens called out to serve, ready at a moment's notice to fight for their country. Hence the Minutemen, a famous revolutionary of revolutionary fame, where they would go home, grab their guns, and be ready to fight. I think that the Founding Fathers were very clear that they thought an armed populace was essential for fighting tyranny and tyrannical government. It's obviously a very different world they were dealing with than we're dealing with today. But nonetheless, I think that is the best way of understanding the Second Amendment. When they talk about the militia in the Second Amendment, they're not talking about the National Guard or some professional select group of fighting men. They're talking about the citizens' militia, we the people who would bring our own guns and be ready to fight. But yet, nonetheless, they still had extensive gun regulation and certainly did not view the Second Amendment as a libertarian license for anyone to have any gun anywhere they wanted.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you point out that, in fact, that for those people who were eligible to be in the militia, and in fact, this was considered to be automatic, provided that you met the age and race and gender requirements. So not only were you just automatically considered to be a member of the militia, but you were expected at your own expense to provide yourself with a gun. It was a requirement that you have a firearm.
That's right. The founders had very significant forms of gun control, such that if someone like James Madison were running for office today, the NRA probably wouldn't endorse him. And among the laws they had were severe militia laws that required gun owners to appear at public gatherings where they and their guns would be inspected, and yes, even registered on state rolls. And they even, as you mentioned, they have their own version of the individual mandate. You know, this is the provision in President Obama's health care reform that's been so controversial and that the Supreme Court will rule on later this year about whether the federal government has any power to require someone to go out and buy health insurance. And some people have said there's no precedent for the government requiring you to go out and buy a product from a private seller. But it turns out that our founding fathers in the Second Congress in 1792 had an individual mandate with regards to guns. They required people to go out and purchase firearms so that they would have the proper equipment to fight a war should the Indians attack, or we need to have a war against the French or the British.
Mm. But here, I think it's a really important point to make, and you certainly do in the book, is that while the founding fathers, your argument is that they did consider this to be the right to own a gun, an important right, and for some people, a responsibility and a requirement, they by no means felt that this was a universal right. Because, for example, black Americans, even free black Americans, were not allowed to have guns.
That's right. And they even barred white men from having guns in some circumstances, law-abiding white men, namely loyalists. If you were refused to swear an oath of loyalty to the Revolution, you were subject to disarmament. It's estimated that about 40% of Americans at the time were loyalists, thought that it was a mistake to have the Revolution, to take on the most mighty military power in the world with these 13 disorganized, ununified colonies. So they also were willing to disarm white men when necessary. But what your question really points out is one of the most interesting and fascinating things I discovered in writing Gunfight, which is the close connection historically between race, racism, and gun control. So many of America's gun laws have been shaped by racism, in the same way that so many other laws, like marriage laws, voting laws, and other areas of law have been affected by racism. Mm.
Well, we have a caller here we'll bring into the conversation, someone who is listening in Coles County on our toll-free line, line 4. Let's go there. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to mention very briefly that, first of all, it was a very important and very good point you just made on race. Number two, I think the Democratic Party in recent decades has made an enormous mistake in supporting further and additional gun control. It certainly helped in a big way to lead to the huge Republican victory in 1994. It also probably was a key element in the defeat of Al Gore in 2000 for president. And unfortunately, I think a lot of working people have concluded that if the Democratic Party wants to take away their guns, as they would look at it, and wants to restrict their gun rights, that maybe the Democratic Party doesn't support working class people in general. Now, I don't agree with that myself, but I think that is the thinking of a lot of working people. And my point is that the Democratic Party has been hurt very, very badly by its gun control positions in the last 20 or 30 years, even though the Democratic Party talks about it very little right now because of the harm that it's done. A lot of people still remember what the Democratic Party tried to do, particularly in the early years of the Clinton administration. So it's done enormous harm to the Democratic Party, unfortunately. Thank you.
All right. Well,
and
you have some thoughts?
One of the most interesting things about that, I think I totally agree with the caller. I think the Democratic Party has long gotten the issue of guns wrong. Even when they've tried to support gun rights, they've generally tried to say, we support the rights of hunters and sportsmen, which really fundamentally misunderstands why people feel so strongly about guns. I think a lot of people in America feel strongly about guns not because they're useful hunting tools. Hunting has been in decline in America for about 40 years now, maybe 50. What people want guns for today is for personal protection in an environment where they don't feel safe, where they feel that there are criminals and that the police can't help them. That's the real motive or engine behind the gun rights movement today. And I think that there's no doubt that the Democrats have been hurt. Ironically, though, some of the most important gun control laws that were passed in the last 40, 50 years were supported not by Democrats, but by Republicans. One of the surprising things I found that it was conservative Republicans who were at the forefront of pushing for gun control laws in the 1960s. Largely to disarm or make it harder for African Americans who were rioting in places like Detroit and Newark or taking guns into the California state capitol like the Black Panthers were. They were efforts by conservatives to stop African Americans from forming what they thought was going to be a revolutionary force armed to the teeth. And so in California, the most restrictive gun control laws were adopted in the 1960s, supported and endorsed and favored by our governor at the time, Ronald Reagan. So the political history of gun rights often switches back and forth, but there's no doubt that today's Democratic Party is suffering because it's not associated with the what many people think is the right position on guns and gun control.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller. This is line one, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'm a Democrat. I support hunting. I support small handguns to protect people at home. But I certainly don't protect assault weapons. I think they should be eliminated in the United States. They end up in drug dealers' hands. There are 10-year-olds that go to school in big cities, and a gang says, we'll protect you because they were attacked by somebody. And then the gang has them help assemble assault weapons. I saw a documentary where an 11-year-old had something like 10 or 11 of them in his basement. Okay? Needs to be more structured. No gun shows. The structure needs to be in gun shops. Thank you.
All right. Well, there, again, I suppose it gets to the problem that you talked about a little bit at the beginning, where people are taking one way or another, are taking maximalist approaches, and that then it seems that for people who are this most stringent advocates of gun rights, they also on their side, it seems that they're arguing for as little in the way of regulation as possible. So they're saying that, you know, why shouldn't the person be able to have whatever kind of firearm that he wants? And why should there be these kinds of restrictions on how guns can be sold and exchanged?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we really have become very divided on the issue of guns in America. But I think that the caller also points to an interesting question. I often hear people saying we need to get rid of assault weapons. But when I ask people more detail about what they mean, what they don't like about assault weapons, often they're not really certain about what they don't like about them. And that I think in some ways sometimes it's the name assault weapon that sounds so dangerous. The truth is most weapons that are considered assault weapons under the law are rifles that shoot cartridges that are not all that powerful compared to, say, game hunting rifles. So people who support hunting actually support people having access to guns that are far more powerful than the traditional assault weapons. Assault weapons are not machine guns. Often we think of them as machine guns, but machine guns have been subject to very heavy regulation by the federal government since the 1930s. What we're really talking about is guns that look really menacing and are lightweight, but shoot only one bullet or one round of ammunition for every pull of the trigger, not unlike handguns or other guns. And in truth, gangs do sometimes have assault weapons, but gang violence is far more associated with handguns than it is with rifles of any sort.
I guess the issue that some people have with these weapons is as you said, well, first of all, is that they're light, and that while it is true that they're only going to fire one shot per pull of the trigger, they also have magazines that can carry a lot of cartridges, and it's possible for one individual now, because weapons, because of high capacity, lightweight weapons, to carry on his or her person some pretty heavy armament, and it would be possible for them to inflict a lot of damage and kill a lot of people as one individual. And I guess the concern a lot of people have is the amount of killing power that one person, wouldn't even have to be a very big person, could carry with them.
Absolutely, and it's a genuine concern, and it's a reason why, say, something like banning machine guns or making it extremely difficult to own machine guns, I think is a very good idea. There's not a legitimate self-defense reason to need to fire automatically dozens of rounds of ammunition in less than a minute's time. However, you know, banning assault rifles does not necessarily stop someone from Jared Lochner, who had large capacity magazines attached to his handguns. So I think that there may be good arguments for restricting access to large capacity magazines, but doesn't necessarily translate into banning rifles that we consider assault rifles. But nonetheless, I mean, I think there's a lot of area for people to agree or disagree about the particulars. I think the most important thing in the gun debate is we need to move beyond the extremism that polarizes us so much that makes it impossible to get gun laws passed. I think it's really essential that we change the dynamics of the gun debate. Whether we ban assault weapons or not probably isn't going to be the biggest impact on crime rates or violent crime. But if we can change the dynamics of the gun debate so that we can move beyond this deadlocked environment, we can push for better gun control laws. It's not a question of whether we need more laws or less laws. We probably just need better laws that are properly formed, that respect people's rights, while at the same time providing for increased public safety so that our city streets especially can be free or at least have the violence limited. Mm. We can't really make ourselves free from it.
Well, it seems that part of the problem here is that the people who are, in a sense, leading the charge for both sides, say a group like the NRA on the one hand, and maybe a group like the folks at the Brady Center, which is maybe one of the best known, biggest gun control organizations in the country, they're both on the edges of the continuum. There doesn't seem to be anybody who is planting the flag right there in the middle and saying, here I am, I'm going to take this middle position where I'm going to say, yes, the Supreme Court has ruled and we support the notion of individuals owning firearms for their personal protection, but we think that there are a number of restrictions that are allowable, legal, appropriate, and we ought to work for. Who is there? Is there anybody besides you? Is there anybody who is standing there in the middle?
Well, and I think increasingly there are people on the gun control side who realize that that the goal that they've had for a long time of disarming America is profoundly unrealistic at this point. There's 280 million guns in America, and they're not going anywhere. We've tried to outlaw alcohol with prohibition. We tried to outlaw drugs with the War on Drugs and the Controlled Substances Act. Both were, in my view, terrible failures. And similarly, if we tried to ban guns, we would have a similar failure on our hands. And so many in the gun control community, I think, have seen that disarmament is not likely to be an effective goal and have promoted more moderate kinds of compromises when it comes to guns. But I don't think that there's a lot of trust that the other side has in them, and they feel that their Second Amendment rights are subject to attack. Ironically, one area in which if we want to identify some group of people that's taking this moderate, middle-of-the-road approach, ironically, I think it's the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. They're respecting the right of individuals to have guns while at the same time upholding gun control laws. The Heller case that I mentioned earlier that we began to talk about, where the Supreme Court rules in that case that individuals have the right to bear arms, but at the same time makes crystal clear there's plenty of room for legislatures to step in and pass good, effective, well-thought-out gun control laws, that the Second Amendment does not ban the legislature from making good efforts to restrict access to guns in ways that will enhance public safety. They just have to do so in a way that respects individuals' rights.
In this hour of Focus, the guest is Adam Winkler. He's professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and is author of a recently published book. The title of his book is Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, and it is published by W.W. Norton. We have some other callers here. Next, we'll talk with someone in the Quad Cities. So this is line one. Hello.
Yes. You were seemingly earlier wanting to vindicate some of these working class attitudes about having guns for protection, and yet I really don't know of any scientific proof that everybody having a gun is going to cause any net reduction in violence.
Oh, well, that's, you know, this ties.
I mean, that may not
very...
be a rational desire on the part of those people.
Well, it's interesting. There's there is some social scientific literature that's looked into whether more people being able to have guns out on the street, concealed carry laws by making these more concealed carry permits more readily accessible. There's been some social scientific studies that have shown that that actually leads to reductions in criminal violence. I think it's very complicated. It's very hard to know whether those studies are reliable. There's been some counter studies, that's for sure. And it could be that many people who have guns for self-protection don't really need them. But you know, if you think it's hard to take away the gun from someone who learned to hunt at the age of 10 with his father and got his first rifle for his 12th birthday, you think it's hard to take that person's gun away. Imagine how hard it is to take away the gun from someone who thinks, I need this gun, otherwise someone's going to try to kill me tonight. Someone might break into my home. That person will never give up that firearm. So whether that belief is rational or irrational, that person is not going to give up that firearm. So I do think we have to recognize that a lot of people do believe they need firearms for self-defense, that firearms are useful for self-defense in many situations, and that's going to make it very difficult to try to get rid of all the guns in America.
Well, I just have some problems with that because it's in such conflict with my own 71 years of experience, having lived in several states. I never once felt the need to have a gun to protect myself.
And well, I think that's a great thing that we should celebrate, right? I mean, that's a great thing that we should celebrate, that you live in an area where you feel that you're safe and you're secure. I mean, that's ideally, we'd all like to have that situation where we all feel safe and secure and we don't feel like we need a firearm. I actually think one of the interesting things when I mentioned earlier about the history of race and racism with gun control, that the KKK began in some ways with gun control on the agenda, and America's gun laws have historically been unfortunately infected by the stain of racism. And one part of the story there is that for a long time African Americans thought they needed firearms to protect themselves from white people who they feared were going to attack them. And I think one of the good news, one good piece of news, is that today African Americans don't generally think that they need guns to protect themselves from white people. That shows that how far we've come in the civil rights movement. That I think for the first time in American history, that large numbers of black people don't feel that they need to arm themselves to protect themselves against racist hostilities. Hmm. So we have moved in a very positive direction on that front, I think.
I want to thank the caller. I have some others. In fact, the lines are full here, but let me just put in a comment from an email here where someone writes in actually that they feel that perhaps some of the heat has been taken out of this particular topic in the last few years compared to maybe where we were 10 or 20 years ago. And the person who was writing wonders, is this just among people that she knows, or do you think that this particular debate is, or at least the intensity of it, is ebbing somewhat across the country?
I think it is ebbing somewhat, now in part because there's no gun control, big push for gun control right now. I think if there was a big push by the Obama administration, for instance, for new gun control laws, there would be perhaps more heat. But I'm also hopeful in my book. You know, we think we're so hopelessly deadlocked on the gun issue, but I think that the Supreme Court's decision in the Heller case that recognized individuals' right to have guns for personal protection, while at the same time recognizing valid space for legislatures to pass gun safety laws, I think that that case can help point us in the direction of getting beyond this deadlock. By providing firm protection for gun rights, will enable those who would otherwise support gun control but think that if I support this gun control law, it's going to lead down a slippery slope to where they take away all my guns. Those people might be more inclined in the future to support reasonable gun control laws because they're not fearful that they're all their rights are going to be denied. And so I'm hopeful. I think we can move beyond the extreme polarization of the gun debate in the same way that we've moved beyond the extreme polarization of racial integration. There's still race issues that we have in America, and it's still a thorny issue in many ways. But it's so different than it was the day the Little Rock Nine tried to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, when people were yelling with hatred and anger at each other just with the idea of integration. If we had sat on a street corner and seen that scene back in the 1950s, 1957, and I had said, well, I think we can move beyond the extreme polarization of racial integration, you would have thought I was crazy. But I think that the Supreme Court playing a really important role there, protecting rights, making clear what people's legal obligations are and were, helped move us beyond that extreme polarization. And I'm hopeful that we can do that with guns, too. Mm.
Yeah, I'm really one of the things that really strikes me is that given the kind of things that people say about the Obama administration and the president's political orientation and their feeling that the president is trying to take away Americans' basic rights, it's really striking that the Brady Center, which is the nation's leading gun control group, has actually given the Obama administration a grade of F when it comes to their approach to guns and gun regulation.
That's right. If anything, President Obama has so far liberalized access to guns by allowing guns in concealed guns in national parks and by allowing guns on Amtrak. Nevertheless, I think this is going to be a big issue in the 2012 election, especially among the pro-gun community. I think there's a lot of people who feel that Obama was just biding his time, waiting for a chance where he could support gun control laws. My own view is that he has absolutely no interest in pursuing gun control laws, that he's too pragmatic, that he doesn't see much gain to be had by reauthorizing the assault weapons ban, for instance. But, you know, I guess we'll have to see how that plays out.
All right. Let's go on to somebody else here. We have a caller in Champaign. They're next in line, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to go back to the intention of the framers when the constitutional amendment was written. To keep a well-regulated militia, one requires long arms. One does not require handguns. How did handguns come into the argument? To my mind, handguns are the scourge, the thing that needs to be regulated and controlled, and long arms, since they're incapable of concealment, don't seem to me to be so much of a problem. And I'd like to listen off the air. Thank you very much.
All right.
No, it's a great point, and it's one of the things that we struggle with in constitutional law, is how do we maintain the core right that has been recognized with current changes in technology? Obviously, the kinds of guns that the founding fathers had were much different than the kinds of guns we have today. Does that mean we shouldn't protect the guns that we have today? Well, we face similar questions with technology with regards to speech, whether the current forms and technologies we have for speech should be equally protected. We generally think that the general approach to constitutional rights is to keep these rights up to date with technology, to allow new technologies to the extent they serve the underlying purpose of the right to maintain their relevance in these new technologies. So I think that this is one of those situations where handguns have become much more useful, much more operable, much more advantageous to use for self-defense. I think as a result, there's been increasing protection for handguns. I do think that the Heller case didn't offer a particularly strong or powerful argument for why handguns should be protected. In fact, the Heller case was hailed at the time as a triumph of originalism, which is this idea that we should interpret the Constitution by light of the original intention or original meaning of the Founding Fathers. But it's not clear that the Founding Fathers wanted to protect or would have wanted to protect handguns per se, and it's also not clear that that things like machine guns should be banned under the Founding Fathers' vision. But yet the court said that people like to choose handguns for self-defense, so we're going to protect that. But people's choices in the marketplace do not reflect the original intention of the framers. That's living constitutionalism, if you will. Mm. So it's one thing that the court really struggled with, that question.
Well, one point here, I did want to just kind of underline or get you to underline the impact of Heller in this sense. And the fact that the court has ruled, and you know what kind of guns we're talking about aside, the court has ruled that the Second Amendment does guarantee an individual to have a firearm for personal protection. Do you think that essentially now we're talking about settled law, that no one, you know, 2 years from now or 5 years from now or no future court is going to say, well, we're not really sure that actually is what this means, and we'll go back on that?
Well, I think that one of the best things that Democrats and people who favor gun control can do is to accept the Heller decision as binding law and not fight against it the way, say, the right has fought against Roe versus Wade. If this becomes a situation where Democrats propose Supreme Court nominees who are hostile to the Heller case, I think it's going to continue the extreme polarization around guns. And I think that the best thing that can happen to gun control advocates is for the Heller case to be accepted and to become a settled part of American constitutional law, because it enables gun control laws while at the same time reassuring gun owners that we're not coming to take away all your guns. And until gun owners are convinced that their gun rights are safe, no gun control is going to move forward, or very little gun control is going to move forward. So if I'm a gun control advocate, I would hope that the Heller case would become a more settled part of American constitutional law.
All right. We are talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Adam Winkler. He's professor of constitutional law at the University of California in Los Angeles and is author of the recent book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, published by W.W. Norton. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of Focus. We have some other callers. And next, we'll talk with someone in Peoria on line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. A couple of things here. I don't have a gun. I don't have a problem with having guns, people having them. The thing that people have to understand, and it doesn't seem to be getting through, is that if you take all the guns away from private citizens, it isn't going to stop the black market from selling guns. And here's the other thing. I know people that are out to put gun manufacturers out of business. Even if you did that here, they would go somewhere else and get it. In the Dark Ages, what did they use? Knives and swords. Okay, so does that mean if we took all the guns away, everybody starts using knives and swords and bows and axes and all that? You want to take all those away? The point I'm trying to make here is that a safety issue. If everybody's so darn worried about guns, then two things need to happen. One is regulation of who gets the guns, and that's that 10 or 12 day wait or that month wait for background checks, for screening, whatever. Secondly, if you buy a gun, it should be like a motor vehicle or anything else. By the way, more people get killed with cars than they do with guns. They need to go through the safety check. They need to go through every year somebody, or every other year somebody needs to go through a training class. There's lots of ways to make guns safer for people, but, you know, all these people, they're so afraid of people with guns. It seems to me, you know, one is of course, the inner cities, but you can't stop them. I mean, it's like Chicago. Does it make a difference that they have no gun laws there? I mean, they have the gun laws there? No, it doesn't, because the guns are coming from the black market, not from legal citizens. People need to start being aware of that. There's lots of possibilities for other people to get guns anywhere in this world.
Okay, let's get again a comment from Professor Winkler.
Well, I think there's no doubt that there is a huge thriving black market for guns that will only get bigger if we tried to ban access to guns. But the truth today is that too often gun control proponents are proposing laws that will not have any reasonable likelihood of being effective, and they have the on the other side, the NRA is not willing to allow the kinds of safety regulations that the caller was mentioning to move forward. You know, one of the interesting things I found in writing Gunfight was that the NRA was not always the diehard, no-compromises opponent of gun control we know today. That the NRA was founded after the Civil War to improve marksmanship training. And in the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and promoting them in state after state. When Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law, 1934, the president of the NRA was asked whether it violated the Second Amendment. And from the perspective of today, his reply is pretty astounding. He said, quote, "I've not given it any study from that point of view." Indeed, before the 1960s, the NRA's publications rarely even mentioned the Second Amendment at all. So the NRA has really transformed and has become a more diehard, no-compromises opponent of gun control, in contrast to how it used to be, which is it used to be an organization that fought for gun control. Not any gun control, but fought for gun control laws that they thought would enhance public safety.
Yeah, that's really interesting that they and that there would have been a time not all that long ago when the real focus of the NRA was the sporting use of firearms. And perhaps it was around the maybe late 60s, early 70s, and in part in response to those people who were concerned about radicals of whatever stripe having guns and arguing for greater regulation there, that it was the response to some people in the organization to that turned its orientation from primarily, serving the needs of sportsmen to the concern about having guns for personal protection.
That's right, and I trace that transformation in some ways to an amazing incident that happened in May 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched right into the California State Capitol building, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They were not there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law that conservatives in California, like Ronald Reagan, were promoting to try to disarm the Black Panthers. And it was ironically these laws, supported by conservatives, that were intended to restrict access to guns by radical, urban, black leftists, that sparked a backlash among, ironically, white rural conservatives who were convinced that the government was coming to get their guns next. And those people eventually took over the NRA, literally in a coup that happened overnight. And the leadership of the NRA was completely ousted at an annual membership meeting in 1977 and replaced by more hardline elements that were recommitting the organization away from marksmanship and sporting shooting to political advocacy and a very vigorous protection of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I thought it was also really quite fascinating to learn that apparently the NRA came into being after the Civil War because people thought that the war dragged on as long as it did because the Union soldiers were such poor shots. And that, so what they thought it would be, it was important for people to learn how to shoot well.
That's right, that's right. It was, it's just, again, one of the things that I found in writing Gunfight, and that made it so much fun for me to write this book, was to find all of these surprising history and historical turns and twists. I mean, the Wild West, for instance. You know, we all know the image of the gunslinger walking through the Wild West town with six shooters on each hip and a rifle in his hand and ready for a duel on Main Street. But one of the remarkable things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that our popular understanding of the Wild West couldn't be more inaccurate, that frontier towns like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, Arizona, they had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. And in fact, when Dodge City formed their municipal government, you know what the very first law they passed was? A gun control law. So it turns out that the very heart of America's gun culture is also part of the story of America's gun control culture.
One more caller here, Belgium, line number 3. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to point out that with a little simple gunsmithing, most of these small hand cannons can be turned into automatic weapons, and they can be done easily. And the thing that I find absolutely most amazing, and I haven't really heard you talk too much about this, is that Illinois is one of two states that does not allow concealed carry.
Actually, I think we're now the only state that does not allow. Wisconsin was the other one, but I think they just passed it recently.
Well, the whole idea is, if you walk into a bar room with half a dozen cowboys with who knows what strapped onto their side, you're in your position where you can be hurt and just be a bystander. What was the logic to allow concealed carry?
Well, that is true that you can be a bystander if there's a shootout, and obviously you don't want to be a bystander anywhere near a shootout. Make my book, Gunfight, the only gunfight you ever get into. You're going to be very, you'll be in better shape. But the truth is we've seen actually over the last 30 years liberalization of concealed carry laws made more permissive, more people with concealed carry permits, more people carrying guns on the streets with permits. And we've also seen, it's also been an era of stark reductions in violent crime. I'm not making the argument that it's concealed carry laws that have led to those reductions, but I would say that it's clear that we have not seen huge spikes in violence as a result of more people carrying these guns on the streets. So the idea that you're going to be a victim of a shootout, it's possible, but we're just not seeing that happen all that often in America. The concealed carry laws have not led to the huge increases in violence that some people in the gun control community promoted when these laws started being adopted. So I do think that it's more nuanced. The truth is the people who are carrying concealed guns with a license, they're the law-abiding people that we don't really have as much to worry about, in most cases at least. There's obviously going to be extreme examples that we should be concerned about. But we haven't seen the kinds of stark increases in violence that some people thought.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have about a minute left. What sort of idea would you like to leave with folks this morning?
Well, I'd leave folks with the idea that America's history with guns is really one of the most fascinating aspects of our history, and that the reason why I wrote Gunfight was because there are so many interesting stories about how America's tried to balance gun rights with public safety, and that you don't have to like guns to be interested, because it's really a story about America and how we've tried to protect our rights while also protecting public safety.
All right. Our guest for this hour of focus is Adam Winkler. He is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles. And if you would like to read more on this subject, the book to look for is his book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. It's recently out from W.W. Norton. And Professor Winkler, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in bioenergy. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu. Support for Stock and Commodity Reports on Illinois Public Media comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, spot basis bids for corn and soybeans are holding mostly steady around the U.S. Midwest, as producer sales are remaining light despite soybean futures rallying this morning to a three-month high and corn rising for a fifth straight session before backing off and regaining some negative territory as we go into the final hours of trade on this particular day. Barge freight eased late last week on Midwest rivers. River bids are nearly mixed, pressured at some points by an increase in deliveries and supported at other locations by thin supplies in the export pipeline. Soy bids climbed 5 cents today at an elevator in Des Moines, while soybean and corn bids are mostly unchanged at most other interior elevators, processors, and ethanol plants. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with how futures are trading. And we'll begin that in Kansas City, looking at the March hard red winter wheat contract, which is at 719, up 6 1/4. The May at 727 1/4, up 6. And the July, 734 3/4, up 5 1/4. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 666, up 5 1/4. May, 678 1/4, up 4 1/4. In July, at 692 1/4, up 3 1/4. March corn, 642 1/2, down 2. May, 649 3/4, down 1. July, 654 1/2, down 1. September, 602, down 2 3/4. And December, 579 1/4, down 2 1/4. March soybeans, 1237, up 4 1/2. May, 1245 1/2, up 4 3/4. July, 1255 1/4, up 5. August, 1252, up 4. September, 1245 3/4, up 4 1/4. And November, at 1240 1/4, up 3. March soybean meal, 327.60, down a dollar. The May contract off a dollar as well. The tick there, 329.10. March soybean oil, 52.24, up 57 at 22 now. And May at 52.65, up 57. February live cattle, 123.90, up 27 1/2. March feeders, 153.55, down 90. And February lean hogs at 87.05, down 47 1/2. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.